My name's Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be alive and sober and here with you guys tonight on a Sunday. It's a lot of material to cover in an hour or 45 minutes or whatever it ends up being. You know, I have 3 weeks that I can give to run through 12 steps. So I did bring my book tonight because I'm not coming from work. Thank you, God. Not that I'm going to get into a lot of mechanics. There's just not time for that. But I have here, I'm sure there's some key points that I want to talk about. But, you know, I started getting into step four towards the end of the last week's hour. And, you know, step four, I had never taken a really hard look at myself in an honest way to see where I may be at fault. It just wasn't in my nature to do so. I felt everything that I did was just and right. It's like, if you ever seen Scarface, when he's loaded in the restaurant, he says, I always tell the truth even when I lie. You know, kind of like that, just ridiculous. Saying I'm sorry, it wasn't something that I was prepared to do, or did I often think it was warranted. So for me to scratch the surface on where I'm selfish, where I'm dishonest, where I'm self-seeking, looking to get what I want, and frightened in my resentment, like, you know, you don't, frightened isn't a word that men in my neighborhood used. And to take a look at fear, and, you know, my sponsor made it really clear to me that, you know, where the book says fear ought to be classed with stealing, it seems to cause more harm. Fear, making decisions based on fear. And I found this out in my fifth step. And what I'd like to say about step five before I even get going is presenting our inventory to another alcoholic needs to be a safe place. All right. So the relationship I have with my sponsor needs to be as safe as I would want my relationship to be with God. And if I don't feel, or if my sponsor is going to ridicule me for how I feel about things, I'm thinking maybe I should find a sponsor who's safe to be around. So as a sponsor, and I know there's other sponsors in here, it's something to think about. You know, am I creating a safe space for the people I'm working with to get honest? Because I'll tell you what, here's how an alcoholic deals with that. We just don't get honest about it. You know, we were just talking about this in a roundabout way about, you know, some of our AA home groups across the country where, you know, you need to look recovered and sound recovered and fit spiritual condition as if the measure is how I look or sound. And, you know, if we're going to judge harshly or ridicule each other for being alcoholic, well, then I'll just pretend I'm not. You know, so I remember my sponsor, back to what I opened up with here, talking about how fear would rob me. You know, it should be classed with stealing, because when I made a lot, I made many, many, many decisions based on fear, and they robbed me of choice. Now, I may not have choice in regards to alcohol. You know, not picking up that first drink, that's a God job. I lost the power of choice in drink. And if I don't believe that, I mean, how many mornings did I wake up choosing not to drink that day? And by day's end, I was drinking. Now, I may not have woken up drunk. So it's not the booze that caused me to have lack of power and choice. It's my mind. I can't rely on it to keep me sober. Okay, I get that. But what about making decisions in my everyday life? If I'm making decisions based on fear, I'm not really making a choice. I'm making a decision based on fear. I'm doing whatever fear tells me. And I didn't learn that until I started to read my inventory to my sponsor. I got to see these things, and fear was always attached to my resentment. And I had fear with no resentment as well. But I got to see how these things were dominating my moves in life, and how the world and the people really dominated me. How I was going to be that day really depended on what happened that day and how you acted that day and whether I got what I wanted or not that day. And most of all, like, my sponsor made it a safe place to just be honest with him about some of the things that were going on in my life and what I was thinking and how I was feeling about things. And I had just started to scratch the surface in step five and enter into a life of transformation where I had a shot at being healed, to where I could expose my woundedness and put a finger on my brokenness, so to speak, so that I could experience healing in areas of my life that I've been trying to protect myself and keep myself safe all my life. You know, my anger was to keep me safe from you so that you couldn't hurt me. And my decisions based on fear was fear of getting hurt, fear of not getting what I wanted. And it bled into all these areas of my life. And I didn't realize that this is what was driving me all these years until I got into my fifth step. And it's really a confession is what it is. It's based on that. I'm not a religious man. I was brought up in a religious school and went to church and I did all that stuff. And after going through the steps for a few rounds, I practice the steps once a year. I just believe it's a good practice. It's never harmed me to go through the steps formally, you know, every year. I practice steps 10 and 11 in my daily life. And I run through the steps once a year, roughly, maybe a month or two shorter or later. It doesn't really matter. But it's like, you know, you clean your house, but every once in a while you got to pull the couch out and the fridge out there and get those dust bunnies out from behind the couch and behind the fridge and do a more thorough inventory. Because I'm capable of deceiving myself. I think we all are. Human beings are capable of deceiving themselves, and you sprinkle some alcoholism on top of it. And I think it's just a good idea. So, but it's really important for me to create a safe place for people to get honest when we're talking about life and death issues and lifelong issues, things that we've been contending with for many, many years. Well, actually, I didn't. They just dealt with me. I didn't contend with them until I tried to stop them. See, and that's where the next two steps come in: step six and seven. I don't have the power to do anything with this stuff. It's like, we got all this stuff here, Scott, that's been dominating your life, but here's the thing. You can't do very much about it. It's a God thing. It's like a sick joke, you know? I need to live a disciplined life as an alcoholic, but alcoholics lack discipline, you know? Without a disciplined life, I'm not going to make it, but here's the thing, you lack discipline. You know, there's these opposites that go on and create big-time challenges for me. But this confession with another man, it was followed up with an hour to take a look. The book suggests that we take an hour. But in the beginning here of chapter 6, into action, it says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying, right? Trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. Now, by the time I had gone through the step five, the first go-around, I mean, I went through the steps with my sponsor from 1 to 12 in about 6 weeks. Now, when these guys got, you know, these books mailed to them, when it was first written and heard about, they were going through the steps very quickly, probably quicker than 6 weeks. And I know if I've said 6 weeks and people are like, whoa, really? And then I know other guys that, you know, they go through the steps over the course of a weekend. The point is that we need to find power and we need to find it right away. You know, you'll hear do a step a year. We'll hear all kinds of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't recommend a step a year. That's just my experience. But what I'm trying to do here is to develop this relationship with God, a new relationship, to where God is a power I can depend upon to help me, to help me with these obstacles that have been dominating my life all my life. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way. See, we're just getting started here. That's another reason why I would recommend staying in the work, going through the work again year after year. My real gold nuggets started to get struck. My pick struck gold in my 10th and 11th step. That's how it happened for me. But I just started to scratch the surface on the stuff. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. Now that's a powerful statement. Nothing I've ever been able to do, but these things will be cast out by God, right? This requires action on our part, which when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. So we're going to get down to specifics. Exactly where was I at fault? And that's where I needed my sponsor's help. I could generally ascertain where I might be at fault in any particular resentment, or where my self-reliance was in any particular fear. But to have a sponsor who'd been sober 40-some years and been working this program all those years, it was really important for me to have that so that he could guide me and point me in the right direction as to where I'm getting in the way. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. And it says, this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. That brings me back to providing a place of safety and non-judgment as far as harsh or, God forbid, sarcasm. There's a lot of that. Somebody will share something at a meeting, and sometimes at my very home group. They'll share something from the floor after the meeting, and somebody will come up to them after and be like, oh, man, don't be like that guy. Or don't, you know what I mean? And it's like, man. Or being beaten up on sponsees and stuff. Busting chops. Like a lot of guys like to bust chops. You know what I mean? Like out at the diner. And I'm thinking, man, what guy is going to come to you after you're such a buster and discuss anything that's really going on? I'm shocked when I hear that kind of stuff. It really makes me resentful. So I bring that stuff to my sponsor. And I forgive. I forgive and I pray and I ask God to not allow me to become that guy. I have to be the change that I'd like to see. I've learned that through discussing these types of things with my sponsor. You know, and we get into this inventory. There's a lot of these promises you'll hear about in a book, and I've discovered that they are real, right? They may not present themselves at the very moment in this book where the book says they do and will, but I've experienced them. After reading my inventory with my sponsor and admitting these things, it says we're returning home. We find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man or woman at last. Is our work solid so far? I've been in the construction business my whole life. I know how strong an arch is. The reason that the Roman Colosseum has stood for thousands of years is because it's built made of arches. It's not because it was so well maintained, that's for sure. But an arch is a very strong architectural feature. Is our work solid? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? If we can answer to our own satisfaction, then we look at step 6. And I recommend sitting there for that hour. Because maybe it's time to pick the phone up and make a phone call and say, hey, listen, there was something I really wish that I would have put down on paper, but I was afraid to. I was afraid of putting that stuff down on paper. Maybe it's some things I was ashamed of. I don't want anybody to find that out. But it's something that might need to be shared with someone immediately. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Do I even consider them to be objectionable? You know, my everyday life is going to show that. If I still see a behavior as being useful, I'm going to use it to try to get what I want. Especially, and the more important things are to me, the more selfishness and self-centeredness wants to get in there and run the show. The more my alcoholism wants to get in there and run it, the more important something is to me. So if my sex relationship, you know, my marriage or boyfriend, girlfriend, or whatever your thing is, don't matter to me. If that love relationship, that sex relationship is really important, I'm going to try to dominate it in certain ways. If my work relationships are really important, I'm going to try to dominate in those areas. If my AA life is really important to me, my selfishness and my alcoholism essentially is going to get in there and try to dominate stuff. If I think sounding really good is important, then I'm going to try to sound good. It brings in all levels of selfishness and dishonesty. So if I've given myself a self-appointed position of importance in AA, then alcoholism is going to be all over it. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Anyway, are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things we admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? And do I believe he even will? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. Then there's a seventh step prayer. When ready, we say something like this: My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad, all of me. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. Now, after that third step prayer, there was no amen. I believe steps 4 through 9, or 4 in my inventory and up to this point, are to be done prayerfully, as well as the rest, 8, 9, and 10, 11, and 12. But this body of work that we just completed, I believe it should be done prayerfully. So there's an amen at the end of this prayer. And it says, we have then completed step 7. But have we really? I believe all roads lead to step 6 and 7 in AA. I think everything that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to get us to step 6 and 7 and essentially keep us there. Even in the daily inventory steps, the first thing it says is that we ask God to remove them at once. We bring them right back to this page, you know, to this step 6. Am I really willing to have God transform me? Am I really willing to have God change me in a way that I'm not even going to know? I'm not going to know what I'm supposed to look like, really. Am I willing to fall apart right in front of your face because it might be necessary in order for me to have a transformation in my life? You know, we want to say a couple of potent prayers and just be, you know, launched off into the promised land where we get a great relationship, a good job, and everything's great, and there's maybe some rainbows and unicorns out there. And that hasn't been my experience, man. My experience has been forged out on an anvil. Really. I mean, pounded out thin like a veal cutlet. That's just how it's been for me. When it's time to change, remove every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. You know, let God transform me as he sees fit. Thomas Merton writes that God writes straight on crooked lines and brings great good out of evil. I've had experiences where, man, they were pretty embarrassing for me. And by this point, I was the AA guy, you know, getting invited here and going there and flying over here and, you know, that doing the whole carry the message thing. And I've come unwound because somebody stuck their finger in an old wound that I had thought was healed over. But maybe not. You know, I experienced abuses when I was a kid by people in positions of authority. And I lost it on a narcotics officer in Kensington in Philadelphia one day who pulled me over and he started abusing his authority. You know, I was just driving down Kensington Avenue. I wasn't, you know, my brother had just overdosed not long before that and died. You know, and he starts giving me the business, checking me out like I'm down there copping dope. And I says, listen, bro, I ain't down here copping dope, man. And he's like, oh, he thinks we, and, you know, he starts giving me this and that. And then I says, why don't you go get the guys who sold my brother that dope that killed him instead of busting my chops? I'm just heading to work, you know. I have a shop around the corner. And he looked at me and he goes, oh, we're going to go get them next. And he kind of smiled at me and I lost it. I was out of the car. I was going crazy. He was just looking to bust my chops and abusing his authority. And I started telling him about it and a lot more. And it was, I couldn't, there was that moment. I think of it like a black hole. You got that disc and then, you know, you're going around this black hole, man. Then there's the event horizon where you go over the edge and you can't get back. And I felt that moment slip away. And where I could have asked God for help. But I was going to keep myself safe that day. And I went over the event horizon, man, and I got sucked into the black hole of self. And I'm lucky I was able to walk away from that. I remember his partner put his head down. And I thought, yeah, he's putting his head down because he knows I'm right. He put his head down probably because he knew I was about an inch away from getting my head bashed in and tased and the whole nine. But it was an embarrassment. I still have an amends letter for this police officer for the way I talked to him that day. And they're like task force guys. They don't know, none of the other cops know where they are or where they work out of. And they move around. They could be anywhere kind of thing. Because I have a picture of them still. I'll be driving down the Ave and I'll see a guy in that. They have a certain uniform, like jump boots and stuff. And I'll say, hey, man, do you know this guy? You know, I'd really give him the business one day, man. And he's like, ah, everybody gives us the business. Don't worry about it. And I'm like, nah, man, you don't understand. Like, this is a life and death errand for me to straighten this stuff out. I believe it. I believe in that. That if I do harm, I have to try and make it right to the best of my ability. But step 6 and 7 takes a lifetime. I mean, how long does it take to be transformed in the image of what God would have me be? How many of us could sit here and even say, I mean, we could throw punchlines out there. Oh, I'd like to be a man of integrity or you know, woman of grace and dignity. And I get it, man. That's great. But like, what's that look like? You know, what's it look like when it shows up in our lives, man? And I have a client that's trying to burn me out of some money. Obviously, just wants to, he wants to me to do work for nothing. Or I have somebody who's in need, a client. And for me to take care of that client, it's going to cost me, man. It's going to cost me big. I had that happen to me. I remember my sponsor talking to his wife. They're telling me a story where, you know, he was in advertising before he became a bootmaker. What a weird shift, man. You know? He had his own advertising agency. I mean, house on the hill, the whole nine yard in them, yards. And one day he found himself an old man in a young man's game. And he was out. It was over. Bye-bye house, bye-bye all this stuff. And he's looking for jobs with other advertising agencies, man. You know, really eating humble pie. And he goes to this one place and the guy says, I want you to do this and I want you to do that. And it wasn't jiving with him. And he says to the guy, come over to the window. He says, you see that car out there? That car with the, you know, the fabric that used to be on the roofs of the cars? It was all faded and paint was faded. He says, yeah, that one with the faded fabric and the chipped paint and stuff. He says, that's my car. He says, I don't think this job's for me. And he quits because they were asking him to do things he didn't believe in. And he said, this moral of the story is he called his wife and said, Marie, we're having integrity for dinner tonight. And I thought that was like some pretty, you know, spiritual karate chop stuff to say, man, you know. But I didn't really know what it meant until I had to eat integrity for dinner for 6 months straight. You know, I took a job that would have been a nice job for me and my crew. And an old elderly couple was burned out of their home in Vineland, New Jersey. And it was a mansion. It was nice. A lot of plaster work over lath. And I bid on it, and here was the price. It was tight, but I knew I could do it. You know, they only had so much money from the adjuster, and that was it. And then all these problems popped up. The job got delayed for 6 months. I had the material out in the driveway. And it, gypsum goes bad. You know, it doesn't just last forever. It wicks moisture out of the air, so there was a risk of that going bad. And then there was some other design stuff that wasn't revealed to me, a little underhandedly by the adjuster. And I, okay, and it's like, man, I'm at the point now where, like, I need to back out of this job. And I took a sizable non-refundable deposit from these people. And we have a three-way, and the adjuster accused me of all sorts of underhandedness. And I kept my calm, when, you know, and just listened to his accusations. And I said, are you done now? And he hung up, and then he calls back to get a conference call with the owners who I had met, very nice people, in their 80s, you know, just been burned out at our house. Well, not good. And during the conversation where, I had the intention of saying, listen, I'm not going to be able to fulfill this contract. You know, it's going to be delayed 6 months. They swore a month or so to get sprinklers put in. And I said, nah, it's going to be more like 6 months because I know how it is. And what I found myself saying, that I heard in this man's voice, he says, man, I just wish I would die in that house. Not that he died in it, but he just wants to live there until he dies. And I could hear in his voice just how defeated he was. And instead of saying, you know, I'm sorry, Charlie, but I'm not going to be able to fulfill this contract, what came out of my mouth was, okay, Charlie, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And I don't even know where that came from. It was like, so, you know, I ask God to help me and move me to make the decisions and do things in my life. It's like saying a few really potent prayers and then all of a sudden your life comes undone. The wheels fall off because it's time to be changed. And, I paid myself. In the end, I had to put guys up in rooms. I lost the crew that I had originally had because they needed to go work somewhere else when the job got shut down. And I tackled this job. And it was a 10 to 12 week job, and it, because of all the one issue after another, it drug out for like 5.5 months after being delayed for 6. It was awful. I mean, I was paying myself like $300 a week just to keep the lights on in my life. And, paying my guys their wages, putting them up in hotel. I suffered depression. It was really bad. It really cost me everything to have integrity. Now, from a business model view, it might look like a bad move, but for me spiritually and in the realm of transformation, it was an invaluable experience for me. So, you know, I had to really unlearn everything I thought I knew or what to expect from God in this process of transformation. You know, if you think of the physical fantasy of God compared to the reality of Him, I had to let go of what I wanted from God to experience what God had for me. What I got to see when I lost my marbles with that narcotics cop in Kensington was that, you know, if somebody is abusing me, I respond like that 6-year-old to 8-year-old kid in a grown man's body, where I'm not scared silent, but I'm like scared enraged. You know, I had to heal from what happened to me as a little boy so that I don't act that way today as a man. I'm not that little boy, and you can't abuse me like that. But that's how I was reacting. I had woundedness, and somebody stuck their finger in it. A week before that, a guy smashed in the back of my Cadillac and took off. And I chased him down into South Philly and caught him, and that got ugly. And I remember calling my sponsor, like, all happy with myself. I didn't hurt him, Mickey. And it was because the guy had popped his trunk, and he had a baseball bat in the trunk. And I slammed the trunk shut real quick and grabbed him and held him there till the cops came. And I'm calling him like, yeah, Mickey, I didn't hurt him though. And it was, you know, and he says, yeah, what if he'd have pulled a gun? How about that? And I'm like, oh man. But again, somebody tried to hurt me and get away with it. You know, so I'm still trying to keep myself safe. I'm 53 years old, and I'm trying to keep myself safe from stuff that, you know, wounded me when I was little. So that kind of stuff needs to be dealt with. And how do I deal with it? It comes up in my everyday life. My everyday life becomes the arena for transformation, and it's not always pretty. I listened to a woman named Caroline Mace. She gives a talk called Spiritual Madness, and she talks about that, the physical fantasy of what we expect from, we expect God to act like a human, in human logic and in human ways. Like, okay, I'm going to choose God, and I'm going to get the great relationship, a nice paycheck, and have all my, and the book says things like, take away my difficulties. I immediately interpret that incorrectly as in make my life easy. You know, taking away my difficulties is really, to me, is to take away my difficulties and relying on God in the middle of all this transformation and messiness. The spirituality and spiritual transformation can be a really messy business. I mean, if you take a look at a monarch butterfly, which I believe are the most beautiful creatures, and they have an incredible life cycle, man. Like, they fly down to Mexico, and it's a lot. They're really being, there's a lot being asked of them to keep it going. And they pick up the torch, man, and, you know, they carry that cross, these insects. And they're guided. They're guided by God to do it. It's wired into them. Just like the caterpillar crawls up that milkweed, and it looks like something you would squash with your foot if you saw one, and it seeks out a milkweed, it climbs up there, and it instinctually goes into a cocoon, and inside that chrysalis becomes, it volunteers to be completely destroyed in order to be made new into that butterfly. And I'd have to ask myself, would I do that? If I really knew, you know, that's why I think this book, and to really to walk the yellow brick road with this book as a guide, it is the road less traveled. I believe so. I mean, who really came here to be completely made new? I came here because I thought drinking was my problem until I stopped drinking. And then I found out that, you know, by running into Scott, that Scott is the problem. And these steps are transformational in nature, and they need to be taken. But it's like, I can't transform all at once. I don't believe it's possible. And the book says we've ceased fighting anything and everyone, and I believe that too. But tell me there aren't some things we don't contend with in here. Just things in my nature that I'm not too thrilled about, that I keep running into. There's things I've been running into for years. Now, does that mean I'm untreated? No. I'm immersed in spiritual practice. It's like if I walk 1,000 miles into the jungle, how far do I got to walk out? I spent 35 years immersed in selfishness before I showed up to AA, and then I spent another 3.5 to 4 years not drinking and not thinking about drinking, but as alcoholic as the day is long, trying to get my life in order according to what I wanted. And do I think I'm going to show up at Alcoholics Anonymous, go through the steps, you know, or halfway through the steps and think that, you know, everything's just going to magically disappear in regards to selfishness? I don't think so. So, step 6 and 7, I believe, are just, it's like the altar that I need to continue to show up to. And really, it's really about AA seems to be, in my opinion, and based on my experiences, it's a journey into my shadow side. Because it's not asking me to write gratitude lists and make inventories of all the things that are going right in my life. It's not I'm not a preacher of uplift, but I'm not a bearer of bad news either. Like, this is good news that we can very easily put our fingers on these things that are getting in our way of being useful and getting in our way of our relationship with God. All these manifestations of self is what it's asking me to look for and watch out for. and continue to watch out for and ask God for help constantly. It talks about later on. Next week we'll talk about that. But just as a talking point, like, what's constantly mean? Is that 50% of the time? Less? 65 constantly? You know, I'm supposed to be reaching out to God all day long, because I need to be changing all day long. And it doesn't end. And that's a good thing. I mean, I'm living the greatest days of my life, and I'm 53 years old. Go figure that out. I've heard guys my age saying, man, my best days are when I was your age, and, you know, when I was in my 20s or something. And my experience is exactly the opposite. The way I used to think about myself growing up in Philadelphia, everybody was a tough guy, you know, and I find out now, like, I'm not tough enough. Alcohol beat me into a sense of reasonableness, and then alcoholism finished the job to where I know I ain't tough enough. I remember a dear friend of mine's father, you know, I remember him saying many years ago, what are you working for? And these guys were street guys. He'd say, Scott, what are you working for me for? He said, man, you're an artist. And I would cringe, like, because I felt artists were weak. Even though I create art, architectural art in my work, being a mold maker and a plasterer, decorative plasterer. That didn't sit. What do you mean I'm an artist? You know. And then he was away for a long, long time. But when he got out, you know, we taken him down to casino. This is just a few years ago. We're driving him down to casino. He's an old man now. He just died, actually, but he was 80 years old, maybe. And we're taking him down to casino, and my buddy Vince is like, yo, Pop, look at the work Scott's doing now and all this stuff. And he looks at a picture, and he goes, he's like, yeah, and he goes, a genius. And I just laughed, you know, because I'm not the same person I was when, like, I was insulted by being called an artist, you know. He was trying, even back then, he was trying to compliment me and say things, you know, complimentary. Like, what are you doing out in the street, man? You got a skill that people would really, they wish they had. You know, back to deceiving ourselves. You know, I remember a client that I did a job for down in Salem, New Jersey, maybe. He worked for a company that they did maintenance jobs and construction projects on nuclear and coal-fired power plants. You know, they're for really big, big, big money, man. And he liked my work. I did all the rest, you know, restored all his walls and ceilings in this very old federal period house, early 1800s. And he says, man, you know, out of all the guys that worked in here, you and your son, you know, you guys did what you said you were going to do, how you said you were going to do it, and in the timeline, and for the cost that you said you were going to do it. And like, my thought was, well, what else is there, you know? He goes, how would you like a job? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, you know, he tells me what, you know, he kind of knew what he did. He says, I'd like you to manage crews, to be a project manager in Texas or California, and you'll get an apartment, you'll get a per diem, you'll get a company vehicle, the gas card, all that, and I'll start you out at $50 an hour, and we'll see where you go from there. And initially I'm like, jackpot, thank you God, this is, oh God, God is good. All I need to do is let go of my life and God will give me a better one. And then I call my sponsor. And he says, well, this is related to how we can deceive ourselves. He says, he goes, wow, that sounds great, Scott. He goes, what do you do? He knew what I did. I said, what's your title? He says, I said, I'm a master plasterer. He says, okay. So in your local, and your plasterer's local, he goes, how many guys in that local can do what you do, the way you can do it? I said, a couple, maybe. Really just one that I actually like look up to. And he's 70 years old. He goes, out of how many guys? I said, thousands. He goes, okay. So how many people in the country that you know, that do you think can do what it is you do? Now, there's 360 million people in the United States. I said, I don't know, a handful, maybe two handfuls. I can't actually say. He goes, but can you honestly say that this is a God-given talent? I says, yeah. Let's put it that way. It's definitely a God-given talent, because when I look at something really complicated design, I know I can make it. I said, yeah, I can make that, and I do. And it's not like it's not anything I did. You know, I was never educated in architectural arts. It's just something I know how to do. And he goes, okay, so you're going to put down this God-given gift and turn your back on it for money. And I'm like, oh, man. Like, why did you have to put it that way? And I said to him, I said, Mick, man, what do you know, like, no more worrying about where my next job comes from. No more, you know? He goes, yeah, no more relying on God, huh? He said, Scott, how much money's enough money? And I'm trying to come up with an answer. And he says, just enough money so that you don't have to rely on God anymore. That's enough money. He said, you know, Scott, you're talking to a bootmaker. You forgot that. Where he doesn't know where his next pair of boots are coming from until the phone rings. And, you know, that was close to 14 years ago we had that conversation. And I've been living God-reliant in my work life ever since. I mean, really all along. I mean, I don't advertise. I have a Facebook page. But it's all word of mouth. My phone either rings or it doesn't. I've had good years, really good years. And then I've had really tough ones. And I've never been dropped on my head. And I gave my life and my will. And, you know, it's like a contract. I will give you my life for my life. And I have to show up to these steps and be willing to be changed in whatever way God sees fit. If the arena is my everyday life where I fall apart right in front of your face, okay. That's how it's going to happen. That's how it's going to go. And it doesn't have to look good. It doesn't have to sound good. But I need to be honest about what goes on in my life and just how difficult spiritual transformation has been for me. Going out and setting right the wrongs. You know, that son of mine, when I was talking about step one, where, you know, my son would be sitting on his stoop waiting for me to pick him up for visitation. And I took that drink on a Friday afternoon, knowing, and I love my son, and I'll be there tomorrow to pick him up. And I took that drink on a Friday, and I don't stop drinking till Sunday. If then. And I'm calling up, sorry, I'm late. Late, I'm a day late. You know, I didn't see my son for a long time. He came back into my life just in time to watch him graduate high school. And he's been with me ever since. And I've got to teach him a trade and a skill that nobody will ever be able to take from him. I've gotten right with his mother. I paid her back a lot of money in child support. His grandparents call me for advice and on concerns with him. I mean, he's 31 years old now, but I had to send him down to a friend of mine in Florida to get right, because he wasn't right. I had to put him out of my home because I knew he wasn't doing the right thing. And he was disappearing, and it just wasn't working out. And it broke my heart to do it, but I had to be a parent to him. So when it's time for God to put me in the arena of transformation, it's not to hurt me. It's to transform me. The way, you know, we feed our children nutritious food. We don't feed them stones. We feed them nutrition. What's going to work for them? What's going to fuel them? What's going to move them? And I had to do that with my son. But now it's like I have a relationship with him that I never dreamed of, because I made that amends. You know, in the amends it says, you know, we have... Well, let me read it. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We're going to talk about step 8. We have a list of persons we have harmed and whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. Now, Not a great many of the harms I caused, some of the worst harms I caused, had nothing to do with my inventory. Except maybe fear. Although a lot of the people I resented, I actually had harmed. But when I was out there getting loaded, like growing up out in the street, if you weren't with somebody, you were fair game. So I remember in 1996, my brother and I had gotten sober. I thought for the last time, I really did. But I wasn't interested in changing. I still wanted to be out there, just not drinking. And one day suddenly showed up at a backyard barbecue, and I found myself drinking a beer suddenly. The thought crossed my mind. So I believe in suddenly. I most certainly do. Anyway, that launched off the worst 5 years of my life. During that time, my brother and I, he was sober and he drank too. We started robbing stash houses and stuff all over the city, typically in North Philadelphia, and because they were easy targets. They weren't going to call the police. They weren't hooked up with anybody that we considered off limits. And it worked out. They weren't going to call the police. They had money and other stuff. And it was just fair pickings. It was dangerous, but that's okay. We did it anyway. Where was I going with that? Oh, now I didn't have any. I had amends that needed to be made in that regard. And then even after that, we stopped doing that. I started preying on regular people. Regular everyday people. I was a fugitive. I ended up a fugitive of justice, and the marshals took me out of my home, and that's how I ended up sobered up. I didn't quit, right? I'm not a quitter. But the marshal service came and took me out because I was a fugitive. They had tracked me down. So, you know, there was a lot of wreckage to clean up, and I was absolutely willing to clean up any amount of wreckage that I had caused out there, because I really believed in it. And it was something I had never done in all the years past. I had bounced in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous from the age of 17. Well, I was in custody till I was 18. So my first introduction to AA was in custody. I was a ward of the state until my 18th birthday. But they brought a meeting in. And I went to this meeting and I thought, you know, I had been sober for a while, not drinking. And I thought, all right, maybe drinking is, I mean, I was drinking alcoholically before that. But I didn't really know what it meant to be an alcoholic, but I just knew drinking was a problem. I said, let me see if I can stay sober. And after I got released, you know, I hit the streets, and the same thing. I wanted to be out in the street and on the street, but I just wanted to not drink. So that doesn't work. So I bounced in and out of AA from the ages of 18 to 35. All right? So now I'm 35 years old, and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. 3 years, 3.5 years go by. I'm trying to set my life up with the wife and bat my sons back in my life, and I got this going on. I'm a stand-up guy again and all that, and I have this disease and discomfort that's under the surface. It's in my subconscious, my unconscious. I'm so disturbed all the time because I have all this unfinished business, a whole lifetime of it. Even though my son's back in my life, I'm a bully. I'm an emotional bully to my wife because she's not. See, I don't show up in a relationship with a list of things that how you need to be, but it's there. I wouldn't hand it to you. It'd probably be absurd, full of absurdities. But, you know, I don't have a list of this stuff. But trust me, I know when you're violating it. I know when you're not living up to it. Because I start getting like, you know. It's really, I think we do it to each other. You know, because she found out I wasn't so charming. And I'm thinking, she ain't that cute. You know, but now we're married. And I'm self-seeking on her, and she's self-seeking on me. But when I met my sponsor and went through the steps, you know, I had heard a lot of, by then I had heard a lot of guys come into AA, and since then, that would say I did everything Alcoholics Anonymous asked of me and I got loaded. And I beg to differ. For one, I got loaded. I never did anything Alcoholics Anonymous suggested in the big book. But when I hear a guy say that, I'll approach him after a meeting and not to corner him or confront him, but maybe get him to see something where, you know, something that he missed or many things that he missed. And one of the questions I ask is, had you made your amends to the best of your ability to be current? And never once was the answer yes. So how many of us are sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous and we don't believe making our amends has much to do with whether we stay sober or not? I know I never did. I never imagined that I was going to go back to people that I had hurt out in the street, except for maybe some of the regular citizens that I had hurt. You know, I had to go back and make amends to a guy I had robbed, a jeweler. And I had a spiritual experience with the guy. He was a very spiritual man. And I realized that when I made amends to him during that process. He said that he had gone home that day I robbed him, and he told himself I was there to repay him for a harm he had caused in a previous life. And the tears when he said that to me, man, were just flowing down my face. I couldn't believe it. I knew right then and there, this is a spiritual man that I had hurt. And he said that he had forgiven me that very day. He thought he deserved what he got. Now, I wasn't going to argue with his beliefs, but from where I'm sitting, it's like, you got robbed that day because I needed a drink. You know? He asked me if I prayed and meditated. I was like, yeah, my eyes lit up. Now I'm getting perked up a little bit. And he reached under the counter and he says, I have something for you. And I thought he was going to pull out a piece and shoot me. I swear to God. I was like, no! No way! I just can't end like this. And what he pulled out was a CD, a meditation CD, Tibetan chanting. Like, what jewelry store has CDs for sale under the glass, you know? And he pulled that out, and he was selling them for like $25 a piece. He says, this is my gift to you. I want you to listen to this while you meditate. And I was just, forget about it. My face was just soaking wet with tears. And I honored his wish for 1 year. I listened to that CD. I don't do guided meditation, but, you know, I robbed him of more than his money. I robbed him of dignity and respect, and he didn't deserve that, and I needed to make that right. So, if that's made it right with him, because I had asked him, how can I make this right? Is there anything you need to say to me? That's when he told me that I was, how he felt about the whole thing. I asked him to make financial restitution. May I make financial restitution? And he says, I can't accept that. And I said, please, I'm on a life and death errand. And if he would have refused, I walk with that. I'm not there to push my agenda or feel like I made the amends. You know, it's like I can get free in step 8. I can get free. It doesn't mean I don't need to practice step 9. But I can get free of the dis-ease and discomfort that comes with unfinished business. When I become willing to set something straight, given the chance, I can get free. Then I go out there and I set it straight. Now, they may get free, they may not get free. Don't let anybody tell you that making amends is all about the other person getting free, because it's not. Some people are going to tell us where to go with our amends, and I still get free. I remember another AA member saying, yeah, step 9, that's where the freedom happens, not for us, but for them. And I thought, okay, you know. I don't know how many guys I've worked with over the years where they, you know, they're making amends, and then 3 months later, 6 months later, they'll call me up, hey, you know, I don't think I did that amends right. Which amends is that? That one like 5 months ago? Yeah, man. It's like, I don't think I did it right. You know, like as if they're, you know, you got to cross all the T's and dot the I's to get the juice, you know? I said, why do you say that? Why do you think you didn't do it right? Well, I went into the guy's store the other day, man, and he just didn't really talk to me very much. He's like, he doesn't like me. I'm like, well, you robbed him. I mean, come on. You know, is it a requirement that they embrace you and hug you every time they see you? Some people just, you know, I'm glad you're setting it straight, but we're not friends no more. That's okay, right? I can live with that. I can live with the truth. As long as my decisions are based in the truth, as best as I can determine it to be today, I can live with it. As hard as that may be, I can live with that. As opposed to living in delusion and making decisions based on self. That I can't live with. But, I mean, how many of us really came to AA to have a spiritual transformation? I mean, give me a break. Until I found out without it, I wasn't going to make it very long. I would die of alcoholism without drinking, as many of us do. But I'm going to leave a few minutes here for you guys. I appreciate the invitation, and we'll wrap it up next week. Thank you.